Okay, well, we left off last time with the Covenanters in somewhat of a disarray. There was after a devastating defeat at Dunbar, they were torn by an internal split between the Resolutioners, those who favored enlarging the army by relaxing the active classes, and the Protesters, who were what you might call the hardcore Covenanters, who favored further purging of the army to make it a pure Covenanted army. The new model army of the English Commonwealth was still in Scotland, and at the beginning of 1650, they defeated the Western Remonstrators, or Protesters, who had raised an army of 4,000 men. The year ended with Edinburgh Castle being captured by Cromwell on Christmas Eve. There was also an act of the Scottish Parliament. It was passed on the 23rd of December, which allowed those who repented of their sins in church to be reinstated. So it was a relaxation of the active classes. And that was a signal for lots of these malignants to come in and confess their sins, say they were sorry, and, you know, and then get back to public life. Which they did this just in time to go to the coronation of Charles II, which was held on January 1st, 1651. So, on New Year's Day, Charles II was crowned at the ancient Palace of Scone. It's 2 miles north of Perth, overlooking the River Tay, which happens to be the largest salmon fishing river in Scotland. Just thought you'd want to know that. Useful piece of information. Coronation sermon was preached by Robert Douglas, an Edinburgh minister. Maybe a little insight into he was a Resolutioner, but he had been... He's an Edinburgh minister. He'd been previously moderator of the General Assembly in 1642, 1645, 1647, and 1649. And then he was again in 1651. Been appointed as a Westminster commissioner, although he didn't go. I don't know the reason for that. After Henderson's death, he was regarded as the leading minister in the Church of Scotland. As a complete, almost as irrelevant as the salmon fishing story, he was rumored to be the son of a son supposedly born to Mary Queen of Scots while she was in prison in Lochleven. There's no positive historical evidence for that, but he didn't deny it anyway. So, after the Restoration, he was offered a bishopric but turned it down. He was removed from the church for not conforming to episcopacy. He's said to have told James Sharp something like this when he was offered the Archbishopric of St. Andrews, which was like, take it and God's curse be with you, or something like that. So, okay, let's see. Hewison described the coronation sermon. After prayer, the celebrant, that would be the minister, expounded the sins of coronation of Joash and the covenant of Jehoiada, and drew out every parallel to the case of his prince. The sins of the Stuarts had made theirs a tottering crown, which now would fall if Charles put on crown and sin together. The covenant bound the king to the nation and to God and must be renewed for the maintenance of reformed religion, the extirpation of false religion, popery, prelacy, profanity, and the unification of the people under the crown, parliament, and church, in the enjoyment of the national liberties. The people expected their king to remember his father's sins and turn good like Joash, to purge the court, cleanse the church, and reform the masses and himself. While disowning extremists, he said a charitable word for the enlistment of penitent malignants. The covenant was the sine qua non. Although prayers are not much in request at the court, said he, the king must pray and prevail. He must avoid the guilt of his meddlesome grandsire, that would be James VI, the first, who laid the foundation for the mischief done by his fathers. On this doctrine, Douglas sought a blessing. Charles swore the oath, which I will read in its entirety, because those of you who know a little bit of what's to come know how he evaded it completely later. I, Charles, King of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, do assert and declare by my solemn oath in the presence of Almighty God, the Searcher of Hearts, my allowance and approbation of the National Covenant and of the Solemn League and Covenant, above written, and faithfully obliged myself to prosecute the ends thereof in my station and calling, and that I, for myself as successor, shall consent and agree to all acts of Parliament joining the National Covenant and Solemn League and Covenant, and fully establishing Presbyterial Government, the Directory for Worship, Confession of Faith, and Catechisms in the Kingdom of Scotland, as they are approved by the General Assemblies of this Kirk and Parliaments of this Kingdom, and that I shall give my royal assent to acts or ordinances of Parliament passed or to be passed, and joining the same in my other dominions, and that I shall observe these in my own practice and family, and shall never make opposition to any of these, or endeavor any change thereof. This is, of course, a complete, you know, outright lie. You might note that he did, it was probably still some compromise language between what he would do in Scotland and what he would do in his other dominions in England and Ireland. Here he says he would give assent to any acts or ordinances of the parliaments that passed to that end. So, there was a lot more pomp and circumstances. It closed with this admonition to Charles: "Sir, you are the only covenanted king with God and his people in the world. Be strong and show yourself a man." Followed by prayer and singing of the 20th Psalm. And let's see, Hewison says, "For an indecent outrage on religion and patriotism, one could not readily find a match to that perpetrated at Scone by the libertine Charles." So. Okay, well, at this point, Cromwell controlled much of the south of Scotland. He had been able to land fresh supplies and troops at Edinburgh during the fall. Cromwell and his subordinate General Monk had a few false starts during the winter. As one writer said, the Scottish winter is not a campaigning season. Charles raised an army, gathering many troops that would have been banned under the Act of Classes. According to Roger Hainsworth, a contemporary or current historian, he was now able to raise an army that would owe its loyalty to him rather than the Covenanter hierarchy. The objectives of this army showed this precisely. Its function was not to drive Cromwell from Scotland and enable Charles to enjoy a Scottish kingship undisturbed. It was to advance on London, attract royalists and all the Republic's other enemies to its banners, and restore Charles to his English throne. So before, they had been just trying to kick Cromwell out of Scotland. Although Cromwell was in Scotland because he thought the English were going to invade, I mean the Scottish were going to invade England. And he said in his accounts of war that if you were going to have a war, you wanted it on basically on the other guy's territory. So, let's see. During the winter, several of the protester ministers preached against the resolutions as involving a conjunction with the malignant party in the land, which they considered to violate both God's word and the covenants. Two ministers, James Guthrie and David Bennett, were brought before the King and Committee of States on the 22nd of February 1651, and they had the chutzpah to decline the King's authority in ecclesiastical matters. Sounds familiar. They were confined to Perth and Dundee for some time. From there, they wrote a formal declinature of protest, which, among other things, formed part of the basis for Guthrie's execution after the Restoration. The first part goes into at length about why they hadn't made their first court date and so on, but the actual declinature part, I have a text of, and we'll... Okay, fellow, be sure to memorize this. "Likewise, we do now protest that we do not hereby acknowledge His Majesty and your Lordships to be competent judges to presbyterial acts and letters, or our ministerial function, or preaching, or any part thereof, which are the subject matter of your Lordship's letter, requisition, and ordinance, because that they are ecclesiastical and belong to ecclesiastical assemblies as the only proper judges thereof. And because neither the Presbytery of Stirling, who are the proper authors of the foresaid letter, which is the first ground of the foresaid requisition and ordinance, nor have we been convened therefore before any ecclesiastic judicatory, neither were ever convened or convinced for breach of any ecclesiastical act in the premises, and so there has proceeded no antecedent sentence of the said judicatories? No, it's judicatories. finding that we have violated any act of the church in preaching against the present way of levy, or that we have ill or unwarrantably appealed from the commission of the General Assembly their desire and charge to us in that particular. Okay, and also we humbly protest that there be reserved to us all remedy competent of the law against the injury we suffer by being thus convened and confined by a civil judicatory, and having your liberty refused to us to return to our charges, notwithstanding of assurance offered to attend at the time to which our business is continued, seeing this procedure is contrary not only to divine law, the word of God, the covenant and solemn engagements unto the acts of our church, but also to the acts of Parliament and laws of this kingdom, and established rights, privileges, and liberties of the judicatories of the Kirk. Okay, and then they go on, and the next one is, upon supposal that His Majesty and Your Lordships were competent judges of these things, and they go on to make their case for that. So, you can almost hear it. There are two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. So, well, the king took an active part in organizing the army. They raised troops. Shortly got at odds with Argyle. Nothing much came of it, but Argyle sort of deserted the king. The commission of the General Assembly was asked several times whether or not they could repeal that, whether or not the Parliament could repeal the Act of Classes. Whether or not it was would be sinful to repeal the Act of Classes. And I'm not sure, Bailey in his letters complains about this, that why are they asking the church or something like that. He thought it was going to cause more problems, but at the present state. Which it may have, but then there you have it. They wanted an answer. They agreed, the commission of the General Assembly agreed that the Act of Classes could be repealed on condition that Parliament first pass an Act for Security of Religion. So the Act of Classes was formally repealed on the 2nd of June, 1651. So it had been relaxed earlier, now it was repealed. They decided it was prudent to have more troops rather than less.
More troops for
Cromwell. Yeah. In other words, to defeat Cromwell, they needed more men rather than less.
And the Covenanters were on Charles' side then?
Well, the Resolutioners were on Charles' side. Yeah, which would have been most of the Covenanters. Most of the church were Resolutioners. But the, like, Samuel Rutherford, Patrick Gillespie, and a number of the stalwarts were on the protester side. What's that?
They would have been on neither Cromwell's
side. Yeah, right. Exactly. They were on neither Cromwell's side nor Charles' side. I mean, in theory, they were in favor of a monarch, but they weren't in favor of this particular one. Which I'm sure was in that sense, they were right, because this guy was, Charles was a real turkey. That was proved, proven by later events. Okay, well, Cromwell, with his additional troops, was able to divide his troops in July, moving a portion of them in a place where he could basically tempt General Leslie to attack, Leslie being the Scottish general. Leslie ordered an army of about 4,000 men to attack, and they met, and after a complicated series of maneuvers, each side moving, the two equally sized armies met at Inverkeithing, looking to Simon to see if there's any recognition. Yeah. Oh, that's pronounced Chicago. It's only spelled Inverkeithing. The Scots lost 2,000 men and 1,400 captured out of 4,000, while the English lost only 8 men.
Oh.
So you could chalk up another one for the new model army. This was followed by the capture of Perth, which cut off the king and part of his army at Stirling off from reinforcements in the north. So the king at this point had very few choices. He could have fled into the Highlands or fled to France. Instead, he gambled on going ahead and going south into England, where he could hope in vain, as it turns out, for a royalist uprising. There were a few military considerations for going south. One of those was that most of the trained part of the new model army was now to the north. If he could get in, he was going to try to get to London. So they went south. Cromwell again split his forces, eventually caught up to Charles at Worcester. It's near Birmingham, right, Simon? And Charles's by the time they got down there, his force numbered 14,000 men. There was no significant royalist uprising. I think there was a small uprising that was put down before they ever caught up to Charles. John Buchan, the Scottish writer, in his biography of Cromwell, calls the campaign of Worcester one of the most brilliant pursuits in the history of British arms. Furthermore, Cromwell had twice the number of troops, so I think you can see where this is going. The Scottish army was totally routed again. Substantial loss of life on the Scottish side, relatively few on the English side. Most of the Scots nobility that were traveling with, that were part of the army were either killed or captured. Their general, David Leslie, was imprisoned in the Tower until the Restoration. Charles himself fled. He improvised a hasty lifeguard of horses and of men on horse and fled, and then he split off with only one companion, spent 6 weeks on the lam in disguise sometimes and in hiding, and he finally caught a boat to France, where he arrived penniless and basically by himself or with his one companion. Cromwell returned to Scotland, returned to London, left it to his subordinate General Monk to finish the subjugation of Scotland. There were some other sort of minor battles, but since the army had gone south and was routed at Worcester, there wasn't much of an armed force, but they had to take, Dundee's the one where there was they stormed the city, and there was a lot of bloodshed and carnage on the pillaging, looting, and so on. Men, women, and children killed and all that by the new model army, which is a little hard to reconcile with them being pure, albeit sectary, but, army. But okay. In the meantime, the struggle between the Resolutioners and protesters continued, and despite some attempts at reconciliation between the two sides, it really was never reconciled. General Assembly met in St. Andrews starting the 16th of July. It had to move to Dundee before it was over because of this battle at Inverkeithing. The meeting was opened by Andrew Cant, who was moderator of the 1650 General Assembly, condemning the recalcitrant policy, which would be, in this case, the Resolutioner policy, followed by Robert Douglas, the moderator, who countered his opinions. James Guthrie protested against some members taking their seats. Professor John Menzies proposed disbarring the commission for their... What's that? Oh, we leave out the Z? And he pronounces it... Menis. Mengus. Okay. Like I said, maybe it's really pronounced Chicago, but... But isn't there a bookstore chain? John Menzies? Menis. Did this guy start it? I don't know. Okay. Well, Samuel Rufford and 21 others protested that the meeting was unconstitutional. This was on the grounds that the elections to the assembly at the synod level had been rigged. The way this was done was the commission of the General Assembly had ordered the synods to cite ministers who had opposed the resolutions, and if you were cited, which I guess is like getting a traffic ticket or something, if you were cited, you couldn't be elected to the assembly. So it was you could say the whole thing was an attempt by the resolutioners to get rid of those troublesome protesters. As we'll see, it's a somewhat complicated situation, but the assembly didn't accept this protest, and by the time they moved to Dundee, there were apparently there were either no protesters, or at least Rutherford didn't go. to Dundee. The assembly's meeting was followed by a publication called A Vindication of the Freedom and Lawfulness of the Late Assembly, etc. It was answered by another pamphlet, The Nullity of the Pretended Assembly at St. Andrews in Dundee. Well, they never did meet up again at another general assembly in, where they were both meeting. Again, history is very confusing. They ended up setting their own rival general assemblies up. So, which this won't surprise anybody who's a student of 20th century Presbyterians that they did this. The protesters authored another book called Causes of the Lord's Wrath Against Scotland Manifested in His Sad Late Dispensations, whereunto is added a paper particularly holding forth the sins of the ministry. This they declared the root sin to be the restoration of Charles II to the throne. And I think that's a pretty accurate analysis. If you look at all these problems that they had, I mean, you could certainly look at this, you could say, well, you know, the English violated the Solemn League and Covenant. Well, they did, but they said they were doing, you know, they invaded Scotland because the Scottish were, you know, setting up this malignant king, you know, and they were clearly violating the Solemn League and Covenant on their end. So, seems to me that if they had not set him up, you know, we can maybe never really know what would have happened, but if they hadn't set up Charles II, that they might not have agreed with the English Parliament. They might have been at a loggerheads, in terms of the English not fulfilling all their end of the Solemn League and Covenant. But beyond that, I don't think Cromwell had any particular interest in enforcing something different in Scotland than the sort of settled church. So, anyways, I think probably the protester analysis is pretty accurate. James Guthrie, as already mentioned, was executed after the Restoration. He was one of the principal authors of this, and this was also one of the things, you know, the evidence is adduced for to justify executing him. I like this quote from Hewison. Setting apart the fact that King Charles was a pledged covenanter, the pamphlet was the rankest treason possible. Otherwise, it was both legal and justifiable. Okay. Well, by February 1652, the subjugation of Scotland was more or less complete from a military standpoint. The English Parliament passed a bill asserting the proprietorship of Scotland, and a Council of 21, including Cromwell, was appointed to govern Scotland and Ireland. And they sent a commission of 8 men to Scotland to help settle the government. They promised justice and protection, a broad scheme of toleration, with liberty of worship to the peaceable and law-abiding. I don't think that went as far as Catholics or Episcopalians, but otherwise pretty broad. They offered a proposal called the Tender, which would have incorporated Scotland into England, and the Scots, for the most part, didn't want to have anything to do with it. Although later, I'm going to have to look at this a little more, that some people must have sworn the Tender or whatever to work with the English. I'm sure some people did compromise to work with the English. Whether or not they signed this document, I'm not sure. But that, get that feeling reading some of this where they mention subscribing the Tender or signing the Tender or something and starting to work with the English. Again, I'm sure it was viewed as a violation of the Solemn League and Covenant. Well, again, we've had now a number of violations, so yes, probably was. Despite the fact that the Tender wasn't warmly received, the English went ahead anyways, if you can imagine that. Ruled the country, appointing judges and a judicial system. They destroyed the royal coat of arms at the Market Cross in Edinburgh. They put down some occasional royalist uprisings, etc. Hewison also comments that the English judicial system was widely regarded to be the fairest and most just judicial system that they had had for some time. So that it was generally thought highly of. Okay, well, in this final subjugation of Scotland, I think when they captured Dundee, also at Worcester, I know they captured 9 ministers. A certain number of resolutioners were apparently taken captive. Robert Douglas, for one, was held in the Tower of London. The protesters went ahead and held their own General Assembly at the same time as the Resolutioner General Assembly. And a little hard to find a lot of information out about what was happening at lower levels, but at least in some cases it's pretty clear that there were like split presbyteries and synods, so presumably that's where these split General Assemblies were coming from. So they held theirs at the same time as the Resolutioner General Assembly during the summer of 1652. It's apparently at the same place also, at St. Giles. Although it's not until next year that they mention that they were holding the two with only a thin divider between them. The protesters came over to the Resolutioner General Assembly and issued a protest against the lawfulness of the assembly, and they were threatened with discipline. Anyways, this confusing situation went on for some time. Let's see, I don't know if I mentioned this, but there was an estimate that of 900 ministers, there were 750 resolutioners and only 150 protesters. Yet in some presbyteries and synods, the protesters held the majority. That was true in Robert. One of the things that, of course, makes Robert Bailey's letters interesting is all the trials that he went through, and one of them was being a resolutioner and a protester-dominated Presbyterian synod. There have been some of these royalist uprisings, and the military governor Lilburn apparently associated the General Assemblies with these. I'm not sure why, but he resolved to suppress them. He asked Cromwell for what he wanted to do, and Cromwell didn't respond. So he decided he would just suppress them himself. So he went in to the... actually, I guess maybe because the resolution or General Assembly was bigger, but he went in and disbanded the whole thing. This is Hewison's account. Let's see. They had their preparatory service, and then Dixon was praying to constitute the assembly when the clatter of hoofs and the tramp of infantry were heard. Lieutenant Colonel Cotterell, some officers, and a guard of musketeers with lighted matches appeared in church. A loud voice with English accent broke the silence. It came from Cotterell, who stood up on a bench and said, "Gentlemen, I am commanded to ask you by what authority you sit here. If you have none from the Parliament, Commander-in-Chief, or judges, you are to go with me." The moderator, having cleared out non-members, replied, "We sit here by the authority of Jesus Christ and by the law of this land, whereby we are authorized to keep General Assemblies from year to year, according to the several Acts of Parliament, and every assembly meets by appointment of the former." Cotterell bade them be gone, or else he would make them rise on other terms. Dixon craved time to constitute the meeting and to appoint the next assembly. Cotterell was peremptory and summoned the musketeers. The moderator's final prayer and protest was interrupted rudely by one of the officers. They stood waiting with their helmets on. Out between the lines of soldiers, the ministers were led and were conducted through the west gate over Brunsfield Links and drawn up near the spot where the trunk of Montrose lay buried. On this spot, set apart for the bodies of criminals, the roll was taken. Bailey, who was there, describes the scene. "When he has led us a mile without the town, he had then declared what further he had in commission, that we should not dare to meet any more above 3 in number, and that against 8 o'clock tomorrow we should depart the town, under pain of being guilty of breaking the public peace. And the day following, by sound of trumpet, we were commanded off town under pain of present imprisonment. Thus our General Assembly, the glory and strength of our church upon earth, is by your soldiery crushed and trod under feet, without the least provocation from us at this time, either word or deed." That was from a letter he was writing to an English friend of his in England. So when he says your soldiery. Okay. What made the situation more vexing was that the protesters sat on a while unmolested, but then their meeting was also dissolved. And to their credit, they drew up a protestation against the unjustifiable suppression of the assembly. So, of the other assembly. So. Yeah, for the most part, the protesters, I guess, were, you know, neither King's or Cromwell's side, which... Well, I'm not really sure. That was supposedly what Lilburn had in his mind, that it would, And of course, the larger part of the church, the resolutioner part, had supported this, you know, Crown Charles and so on. And I suspect that was the main reason why he wanted to suppress them, you know, keep them from meeting. So actually, then the General Assemblies weren't to meet again for some time. So,
did you ever read any of those guys ever show any sort of insanity in conscience or anything like that in the idea of trying to bring Charles to the throne, knowing that he was a Catholic? I mean, his commanders, you think, would have just been ashamed to death if he was in the throne.
Yeah. Well, supposedly a number of them did realize after the fact that it was a big mistake. I think I mentioned Alexander Jaffre already saying that, you know, they had, you know, they were sinful in doing it. That, and basically, I guess you could say their main sin was bringing Charles over and getting him to swear, you know, to swear the covenants. Is if just signing this piece of paper then would sort of make everything all right, when of course they knew his heart wasn't in it, but they had this idea that if he signed the papers and he would sort of live by what he signed, that everything would be all right. Yeah, a number of them did repent at some level. This later on, we'll come across some of it, but.
I don't know if that would have made him any better with the English than the fact that they had renounced the papacy.
Oh, well, and certainly the number of the protesters who effectively did this early rather than later did get along reasonably well with the English. Patrick Gillespie, George Gillespie's brother, was supposedly one of the few ministers who actually prayed for Cromwell. Although I think you also see that them getting along with the English better, sometimes they used it for their, I guess you could say, for their own ends. And that also certainly caused more hard feelings. So they were able, with sort of the support of the English army, to get, say, more ministers into churches and so on, sometimes by, you know, with an English soldiers behind them, basically. Gillespie was appointed... I think principal of the University of Glasgow or something. We'll get to this next week, but over, you know, the protest of the resolutioners that he was being appointed, Bailey particularly despised Gillespie's administration of the college. He was writing about the time of the Restoration. He was writing a letter where he said that the PG's, Patrick Gillespie's, good administration, we're now like £20,000 in debt. That's right. So people were complaining against university administrations even then. Any questions from the back table back there? Should I quiz you to see if you followed what we were talking about? Dave.
When Guthrie and the other chap were detained after, what was Charles trying to do that was infringement upon the church's authority? What was the incident involved in?
They were preaching against the resolutions that would allow the people who were under the Act of Classes, it was against relaxing the Act of Classes, they were preaching against that. And Charles, I can't remember the exact sequence of events, but I know I think he tried to get the commission of the General Assembly to do something about it, and then they called those guys up before him and the Committee of Estates. And not really sure of the outcome. I suspect that they were confined to Perth and Dundee, and then Charles went south and was defeated, and they probably just left, you know. I mean, that was... So... But Guthrie was later executed. I think William Guthrie was envious of his cousin being executed for the faith. So, okay. Well, next time we'll go on. I would think we'll cover most of the rest of the interregnum period before Charles is restored next time, I think. Deo Valente. So let's close in prayer and